Wisconsin's Afternoon News is on the air, broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. Here are your hosts, John McCure and Julia Fellow.
All right. Happy Wednesday. Hope your week is going fantastic. Coming up, Major Garrett, CBS Chief Washington Correspondent, with us live in about 5 minutes here on WTMJ. Harley Davidson with another earnings call today, and these have become like, oh my gosh, poor Harley. Let's listen to how rough a time they're having. Adam Roberts has been monitoring the call and the news today, including comments from the new leader. Adam's with us in the studio.
So that's right, John, Julia. So going through some of the reportings from new CEO Artie Starrs, formerly of the Yum Brands, think KFC, right, restaurants like that, just crossed over his first month with the company, and on his first earnings call, just listened to him making some comments, and the hard numbers are what they are, about $370-ish million in net profit, which isn't terrible, but when you look at how sales are doing globally, the trend down, as you alluded to, John, still continuing on this call, off about 6% compared with the same quarter of last year. Tariffs also impacting the company to the tune of about $45 million just this year alone. But what I was interested to hear is the Q&A with Artie, because all the investors want to know, okay, you have the numbers in front of you, what's the plan? That was a lot of the hitting against Jochen Zeitz, especially towards the end. Well, according to Artie, the plan to get those numbers back up involves the young people.
Having gone through Rider Academy, it was an amazing experience. I think there's an opportunity that it can be a bit more fun. Young people are looking for something that's fun and maybe has seriousness to it, but maybe not as serious as we're currently presenting it.
So Artie just recently actually got his motorcycle license at the Dallas Harley-Davidson facility down there. So, yes, he is actually a certified rider now. And I actually have audio of him going to a local high school to try to roll this program out.
How do you do, fellow kids?
No, sorry, that's the wrong cut. But, yeah, the plan is to target the youngins and get a new generation of bikers because, and I'll play another thing from Artie here, as I think most people will attest to, the overall arching feeling around Harley is that it's made of a bunch of older dudes.
Some of the, I think, the imagery that people have of Harley, we're reinforcing the fact that, some of our riders are a bit more mature. Practically speaking, the product line that we have coming, and specifically the Sprint bike coming in the second half of next year, I think addresses two things. One is a bike that's lighter and easier to maneuver. And the second thing, it's a bike that's more affordable. If you walked into a Harley dealership right now, the price point's pretty high for a young rider to be interested in Harley. And I think the combination of brand, product, and some augmentation to the experiential elements that make it more fun, I think we have a recipe to do that.
So going over some of these median prices, he mentioned, already did, the Sprint, which is the lowest price entry-level street bike you can get from Harley. That goes at about $6,000, which,
okay,
right, that's not too bad.
That's right.
Now, is it like your stereotypical full-hog Harley? No, it's closer to like a Honda bike than anything.
Yeah.
The lowest cost for a 2025 actual, like what I would consider a motorcycle bike, is the Spinster, which goes about $10,000 MSRP. Average price for a new one right off the lot right now, those about $25,000.
Oh, that's a lot.
Well, they got to compete with Vespa and stuff. I mean, Brandon bought one for $40,000.
That's so much money.
And especially in our area, like, you're not riding a Harley 9-10 months a year.
Exactly.
You're putting it away for about 3-4 months. And on the high end, the CVO Road Glide, that's $65,000 for a bike.
65 grand for a bike.
You may be thinking, why would someone who's never run a Harley before or rode a Harley before be doing all of this and like be at the head of this? But it is a lot of brand recognition, and a lot of people aren't buying the bikes every year, but the clothing that is huge with sales. The last CEO was the head of a shoe company.
Yeah, and was terrible. So maybe we should go with somebody who knows a little bit something about bikes.
You're right.
He is Adam Roberts. Adam, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
She is Julia Fellow. It is 5:13. Isaac Marquardt producing the show this afternoon.
Debbie's on traffic.
Next, Debbie on traffic. So yesterday about this time, Julia and I made sure we had the TVs right where they were supposed to be because we wanted to see Major Garrett, CBS's chief Washington correspondent, on the evening news. And he was there.
We have it on mute. Major, we saw you. And it was like, oh. You were like glowing. I said, he was the sexiest man alive. I need a recount. This
right.
was rigged.
Jonathan Bailey, get out of here.
Total rigged.
Yeah.
Who's this Jonathan Bailey anyways?
He's got nothing on Major Garrett.
Who voted on this people's magazine?
We demand a recount.
Yes.
Wow. This is the only precinct in America where this conversation is going on.
Hey, Major, I wanted to ask you about Dick Cheney. We have not spent a lot of time on Dick Cheney, but he was a monumental figure in American politics, but also has a complicated legacy. How would you describe the legacy of Dick Cheney?
Two words. Unitary executive, that's two words. That's one. And Iraq. Dick Cheney did a lot of other things in American political life. But I think if you were to summarize his most important role in the presidency, and specifically the presidency of George W. Bush, you have to put those two at the top of the list. What do I mean by unitary executive? Dick Cheney, who was chief of staff at age 34 to Gerald Ford, coming out of the Watergate era, saw Congress encroaching on a lot of executive branch powers. He thought that was a wrongheaded way for our government to function, and he developed this theory that now runs very much aggressively through the Trump administration 2.0 about the unitary executive. All sorts of powers in possession of the executive branch that the federal courts and Congress can inquire about, can in certain respects check, but mostly has to get out of the way of. What the Trump administration is putting in motion on this front, expansive executive powers, owes its intellectual origins to this unitary executive theory. And then Iraq. After 9/11, and remember, Dick Cheney was at the White House on 9/11 that morning. George W. Bush wasn't. He was in Sarasota, Florida. I was covering him in Sarasota, Florida. Dick Cheney was transformed by 9/11, and he said and made it an imperative within the Bush administration that not only will there not be another terrorist attack on our shores like 9/11, but this government will use every tool to find, imprison, and harshly interrogate anyone in any terrorist network who might threaten the United States, pushing legal limits on that front aggressively, and then go to Iraq. He was among the most forceful advocates for invading Iraq, toppling the Saddam Hussein regime, and pursuing what was never there, weapons of mass destruction, leading to a bloody occupation, lots of money, lots of treasure, and lots of things in Iraq that really never came to fruition as imagined by the Bush administration. Lots of other things he did in his political life. But those two things live with us today because we are still traumatized by what didn't happen and what we didn't find in Iraq. And we are living through this very muscular executive branch, which got started intellectually with this idea of the unitary executive.
John and I were in Washington, D.C. just this past weekend amid this government shutdown. And by that time, they hadn't voted last Tuesday for the 13th time, 14th time. There's nothing going through. And on 60 Minutes, the president is saying he's not talking to Democrats at all about anything. Do you think that he is having other people talk through the channels now? Is this what we're doing for this government?
So we keep that's a great question. It's a great, great question because we keep trying to find out if these back channel conversations, which must precede any sort of deal when everyone's as locked in as they are publicly right now. You can't publicly jump to a compromise unless you've really laid the groundwork through back channel negotiations. And they're just not detectable. If they're going on, they are massively, massively secretive. And we just don't detect them happening. There are lots of conversations that people who like to create deals in Congress are having. But unless there is involvement with the president directly or emissaries he has designated, like the Treasury Secretary, or his director of the Office of Management and Budget. The only problem with that, Julia and John, is those two people I mentioned, the Treasury Secretary and specifically the director of Office of Management and Budget, don't have a lot of trust on Capitol Hill with House and Senate Democrats. They don't believe their assurances. So what the Democratic leaders, Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer, keep demanding is direct face-to-face conversations with the president where they can get him to basically say, this is the outline of the deal. I will support this deal. Republicans, you can vote for it. and I won't attack you for that. Until that moment starts happening, the shutdown will continue.
Yikes, so how much longer could this go on?
Yeah, we keep trying to, like everybody's asking that question.
Yeah.
And the president said this afternoon that he believes the losses yesterday for Republicans, and they lost across the board,
yes,
was in large part because
did.
Of the government shutdown or Republicans being mm-hmm. blamed. He said that, but is that enough to move the needle?
There was an anticipation as the polls were closing last night among Republicans and Democrats that the election results, if they were decisive enough, could break this fever of deadlock. The results were decisive. 14 points for the Democratic nominee for governor in Virginia, Abigail Spanberger. 13 points for Mikey Sherrill, the Democratic nominee for governor in New Jersey. Proposition 50 in California passes by a 28-point margin. Huge decisive results on the Democratic side. The president now saying the shutdown was a problem. What do you do when there's a political problem that hurts you and your party? You try to solve it. That is uniquely the obligation of the President of the United States, the leader of the party that runs the House and the Senate. The president is giving some indication he might budge, because when you first identify a problem, well, the shutdown, then you are somehow obligated to at least attempt to solve it. We haven't gotten to that solve problem yet, but at least he's identified something that undercut Republicans on Tuesday night.
All right, Major, the shutdown will be solved in 5 days. That's the over-under. Are you taking the over or the under?
I'm taking the over.
Ooh, all right. That's into next week for sure.
Mine would be closer to 10.
Okay. Wow, well,
hopefully 10 from today.
A lot of people are hoping that that does take place within 10, because that Thanksgiving holiday traffic is going to be a disaster.
Here's what I will say on the downside. If this isn't resolved before Thanksgiving, it may not be resolved until after the new year. I mean,
whoa.
Thanksgiving has got to be a break point.
Yep.
I mean, honestly, traveling, concern about not only cancellations, delays, but just overall safety, functionality. The United States of America, we ought to be able to function, and certainly through a massive holiday in which we take pride in all the things that this country has been blessed with and created for itself. This ought to be resolved by Thanksgiving at the absolute latest.
Well said. Major Garrett is CBS's chief Washington correspondent. You can catch him on The Takeout, wherever you stream all your news and information. Major, we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Talk next week. Thanks.
All right. Chief Meteorologist Brian Nesnansky is with us from the Palatial Weather Center at the TMJ4 campus. Wow, did that sound really big, didn't it?
Well, it is big.
It did.
It is.
It's
big.
Expansive.
It is expansive. Yes,
we got space in here for lots of activities, and including snow prep and forecasting.
No.
Okay, what are we? Are you guys doing team coverage on Saturday or anything like that, or Friday?
Oh, do not give them any ideas.
Okay, at this moment. Good.
No, it does not look to be that big. As we talked about before, watching the system, but we're getting closer and closer to this event, and the models are starting to get more and more agreeance that the track of this center of low pressure with this clipper, if it goes across northern Illinois, which it looks like it's projected to do so, we will see some snow mixing in with the rain. Now, the big question will it snow hard enough to offset the warm ground and warm air temperatures to actually accumulate? As of right now, if I had to guess, I would say much of southeastern Wisconsin will see at least some coating of snow on the grass. I think the pavement, especially because the day before on Friday, is going to be 61 degrees. So
yeah.
The ground is going to be warm. And I don't anticipate much accumulation or much issues on the roadways. But, of course, we'll be fine-tuning things. As of right now, it does not look like a big event.
Oh, Brian, you know what they used to make us do? I think it was before you got here. The first mm-hmm. snowfall anywhere, like significant snowfall in the state of Wisconsin. John, do you remember this? They would send the newbie reporter up,
to
Wausau. Do you remember that?
I do. Now that you say that,
they sent me up.
Stand in the snow.
Yeah.
It was cool. We had the sat truck, but you know, it was a long drive to the first snowfall in
forever.
Our state.
Yeah. You're going to Eagle River.
Yes.
Why? Because they're getting snow up there on Friday.
So, when I first came here to the TMJ4, and I was coming in from Green Bay, we just got our new Storm Chaser truck, and I know they wanted to use it, and they wanted to use it properly and things like that. This was a different management team for the most part at the time, news director and stuff. They wanted us in the morning to be, whether it was rain, snow, or shine, they wanted me to be in a different location, a different town, doing the weather.
Oh, I remember this. Even in the pandemic.
For each half hour of the show.
Oh,
so,
my.
Like, we would have to be in, like, four different towns every half hour of the show, setting up in the dark, getting the graphics, everything ready. And, like, fingers crossed everything would go right. And, I mean, me and Dave Pozorski, we were just... like non-stop racing, but we would map it out. Like literally we would find a place, you know, you know, like there's a spot like where you could hit Germantown, Menominee Falls, and let's say Richfield all within like the same like corner.
Brian's the big boss now.
So we made it work. Thankfully, things were dialed down because, like, I mean, you do sacrifice, like, the product a little bit. Like,
totally.
The lighting isn't good. The risk of not making it to air. They backed off, thankfully.
Thank goodness that is just a distant memory. We got to get to the forecast, but I do want to mention there's a big old moon tonight, right?
Yeah, tonight is it the full moon? It is the full beaver moon. That's the November. I see you, Julia.
Is that the
laughing.
Meteorological name? Okay, let's just go with that.
I saw his super.
You saw
like,
what?
Is he really doing that?
Well, what the reason is, I didn't
hear it. Go ahead,
I'm glad I didn't. The reason is the beavers this time of year, they like to get their whatever their home is on the stream all ready and tidy for the winter season. So
that's true.
So
that's true. Okay.
So
that means basically the moon is a little brighter and looks a little closer. Is that?
Yeah, it is a super moon too, and it is the brightest and biggest moon of the year for us. So it is a big one. And the good news is that we have clear skies. So if you want to go check out the full super beaver moon, you head on outside. I knew you'd like that, Julia.
Let's head into the forecast. Let's lead us through the full beaver moon tonight and the rest of the forecast.
Yeah. Gotcha. Clear skies tonight. Perfect viewing for that moon. Low temperature tonight, 36. It's going to be pretty chilly. Maybe some frost tonight. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, 54. Friday, a pretty good chance for some showers tomorrow night and into Friday morning. Pretty brief, not a big deal. Then we're dry again most of the day on Friday, up to 61. That feels great. The high school football game, some big ones. High school playoff action should be nice. Saturday is when things head downhill. Dry for most of the day, and then that rain-snow mix moves in likely late afternoon, early evening. Some minor accumulation on the grass, a high of 43, and then still maybe some flurries along with some strong winds on Sunday, and a high of only 38 degrees on Sunday, guys.
Whoa, that is chilly. Chief Meteorologist Brian Nesnansky, thank you so much, Niz. We'll catch you again tomorrow.
You bet, guys. We'll see you.
542 at WTMJ. Emotional stuff from the last honor flight of the season. That's up next on WTMJ. Stars and Stripes honor flight. The last flight of the season was this past Saturday. I was on it. Julia was on it. About 150-plus veterans on three planes. Our flight of champions flew from Wisconsin to D.C. and came back. It was an amazing day.
It was an amazing day. It made me understand the magnitude of what these men and women went through, especially the young men. I think not a lot of us really understand the magnitude of the time when people were being drafted in the Vietnam War. It was televised and aired live on the radio.
The Draft Lottery. A live report on tonight's picking of the birth dates for the draft.
Pursuant to the executive order, the Director of Selective Service is going to establish tonight a random selection sequence for induction for 1970. I will ask Congressman Perney to come forward. Congressman Perney is representing the United States, the Military Affairs Committee of the House, and he also is a senior Republican president who has been the watchdog committee of this selective service system, and we're going to ask him to choose the first one.
So what's happening next? There's a glass circular container. It looks like a fish tank, but it's full of blue plastic capsules containing slips of paper with each possible birth date. January 1st to December 31st, including February 29th, leap year. He rummaged his fingers through the pile, pulled out the first one, opened, then read aloud. Mind you, my father was watching this. He's born September 12th. So you hear the month first, so people are on the edge of their seat when they hear the month. And here was the first one drawn.
September 14th.
September 14-001.
So imagine being a young man that age, or their mother, their father, grandmother, grandfather, uncle, aunt, friend, wife, brother, sister, listening on the radio or television, see if their loved one's birth date would come up. Here's CBS reporter on that historic night as the draft lotteries kept being named during the Vietnam War era, and here you go.
Here at Selective Service Headquarters in Washington is CBS News correspondent Roger Mudd.
Good evening. It was 29 years ago that the first and most famous lottery number, 158, was drawn as the United States entered World War II. Tonight, for the first time in 27 years, the United States has again started a draft lottery. And the famous first pick tonight is September 14th. The first birthday that now is designated 001, which means for 19-year-olds born on September 14th, that beginning in January, local draft boards will induct those men born on September 14th, barring deferments. The next.
So, during the Stars and Stripes honor flight, we spoke to some of those men that were drafted or saw their buddies drafted. And you know what the 11,000th Stars and Stripe honor veteran did, Michael Heft? He enlisted himself because one of his buddies, he was watching television with him and was drafted.
Floored by it. He said, "We have a big surprise for you." And took me off and awarded me with a medal and a cap and a sign. And way too cool. Pretty cool.
Are you looking forward to today?
Oh, absolutely. All of it. All of it's just going to be awesome.
It was awesome. The Vietnam War is considered by the U.S. military to have lasted from August of 64 to 73, and then the draft, based on birth dates, started December 1st, 69. I spoke to another Purple Heart veteran, Mark Rouleau, Corporal Vietnam, Marine Corporal in the Vietnam War. He wanted to set the scene for us on what the Marines wear before he talked about how he got his Purple Heart.
We wore flak jackets. It's a fiberglass vest. We never wore any shirt, just that flak jacket. And it's just a vest, and it stopped shrapnel from like a grenade or artillery.
He said there's a tag on the back of every vest. And the tag said 97% of all combat wounds are caused by shrapnel. Wear this wisely.
And it was in January, and it get a little cooler. I had an old one, and it didn't zip.
He kept it on. And here's what happened 2 days later, January 24th, 1966, even though that vest did not zip up.
2 days later, we were coming out of a village, and a sniper shot me. And what happened was he shot me on an angle. And there's fiberglass pieces inside that flak jacket. They're like a little bigger than my hand. And it's right here, one piece overlapped the other. And it hit right there in a double thickness, knocked me right to the ground.
On your shoulder?
Right here.
He's pointing to the bullet, slicing his entire back from shoulder to shoulder. And here's this.
But the bullet didn't go in, but it ripped me open from the impact. And it knocked me to the ground. So the corpsman came up. Said, "What happened?" I said, "I think I got shot, you know." So they said, "Let's go in a hut here." And the impact ripped my back open, and they bandaged that. But
thank goodness you were wearing that.
I'd be dead. But I mean, the thing, I don't know what this body armor is now. I don't know if it can stop a rifle, but I mean, where if that's a direct hit on the slack jackets, it would go right through it with a rifle. It was the angle that the bullet's power went to the right instead.
The physics, yeah.
Yeah, and I have the bullet. I dug it out. I've got.
It was in your body?
No, it was in the back of the flak jacket. It's like all the way through, like from here to one end to the other. But I cut it out, and I got it in the box with the Purple Heart.
So right next to his Purple Heart is that bullet that nearly killed him. And he was looking for names on the wall of his fallen soldiers.
I was on light duty for a week because I couldn't wear a flak jacket. Mm-hmm. They sent my mother a telegram, said I was hospitalized in Da Nang, and military analysts would say the same. I never went to the hospital. I was treated in the field. Okay, and then I was on light duty for a week. Swelling went down. I'm back in duty. Went back to that village. Russell Hatton got killed on February 1st. I saw his name. He was from Detroit, and his brother had been killed in the Korean War. So, I mean, he got shot in the stomach and just really spit up a lot of blood. He bled to death, I think, you know. And it's just all these years, I had to send pictures to guys I know. You can't explain it, you know. Like, this buddy of mine who lives in California, he says, he always wants you to go to the wall. And I text him, I said, I'm at the wall. I'm at the wall. Rich, he's a good guy, I swear.
That's amazing. You okay, brother? Oh, that's it. He texted you back. He knew. He knows you.
He got shot in the arm during a truck. They got ambushed. He got shot through the arm. There were 18 guys in a truck. 8 of them were killed. One guy grabbed a 60-millimeter mortar and started firing, or they all would have been dead. He said they made the medevacs, and because he was just shot in the arm, he was the last one. He said all that was on that helicopter was the crew and body bags and me. There was just body bags and the crew and him, because he was alive.
He was so happy, John, to be there, and it's all thanks to the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight. The first time he saw the Vietnam Wall, he's there in the 60s. John, it wasn't built yet.
Right.
And here is his impression.
Very moving. Very moving. And when I think back, you know, that guy who was sitting with us had 4 Purple Hearts. I knew people that had 2 Purple Hearts, but I never knew. That's unbelievable to me.
So
wow.
He's talking about one of the Purple Heart veterans,
yeah,
Cohen.
Yeah, he was on our
David
bus.
David Cohen, yeah. Yep. So I went up to him and he showed me a photo of his Purple Hearts, and he has it all. And you know what he told me? He said, I don't have 9 lives, I have 4, because he has 4 Purple Hearts. So many heroes.
So many heroes. Cohen was a company commander who lost 11 or 12 guys on the same day. I'm so glad you got to talk to these guys, and I'm so glad you're sharing their stories. It's what Honor Flight's all about.
I'm honored. Thank you.
If you text the word veteran, you can see photos of David Cohen's medals. You can see all our coverage. You can find out how you can help Honor Flight fly more veterans. Text the word veteran to 855-616-1620.